wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm John Nelson. Today, Bill Resnick speaks with Tom Athanasio of EcoEquity about developing plans to stop global warming. Jan Hawken talks with author Prerna Gupta, who has contributed to a new collection of essays called Making the Unseen Visible, Science and the Contested Histories of Radiation Exposure. And Laurie Mercier will conclude speaking with Julia Ford of Jewish Voice for Peace, Portland. First up, Bill Resnick talking with Tom Athanasio, founder of the organization EcoEquity. They discussed the left's emerging plan to stop runaway global heating, how it can prevail over corporate elites, and their reliance on very expensive and unproven technologies to combat global warming. Here's Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Hi, Tom Athanasio. Welcome again to KBOO.
Hi, Bill. How are you doing?
Doing good. Talking to you. Tom Athanasio founded the organization EcoEquity, now affiliated with the Earth Island Institute. EcoEquity's mission is to demonstrate that success at reducing climate change to manageable levels, that is, saving the planet, will require international cooperation, in particular that the industrialized countries of the West, they've emitted the bulk of greenhouse gases for the last 50 years and created the climate crisis. They have an ethical obligation to send funds and a practical obligation to send funds and transfer technologies to enable poor and developed countries who have contributed near no greenhouse gas emissions, but they're now deeply suffering from climate change. They need resources, especially to adapt their food and water systems, but the rich countries have resisted. That's despite setting up a special fund for that purpose. Rich countries have contributed to the fund. It's a bit of greenwashing by them. A lot of it goes on. He's just home from the UNFCCC, that is United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, their 28th annual conference that mostly avoided the rich countries' obligation to the poor nation. But something unexpected and noteworthy did happen at the 28th. That's one topic we'll be discussing today. Is that action meaningful? Is it meaningful or just more greenwashing? And we'll also be discussing whether the UNFCCC can resist corporate pressure to adopt the corporate plan for dealing with climate change and give equal time and support for the emerging left plan known as energy democracy. First, Tom Athanasio, tell us about the UNFCCC's and the conference's history and purpose. There are meager accomplishments compared to the necessity, and like who attends the conferences, who votes, who sets the agenda.
Well, I mean, the UNFCCC was spun up in the early 1990s after the Earth Summit, and it was charged with negotiating a global climate treaty that would stabilize the climate system. And it's a process that involves the parties, that is to say, the countries. And it's limited by the fact that it has no way of making decisions except by consensus. Bill, I don't know how long you've been on the left, but maybe you've been involved in some projects that used consensus decision making, which can work well in some cases, but imagine trying to do something as complicated as completely reworking the political and economic infrastructure of a global civilization like ours by consensus. And you might then easily imagine why it's so difficult for the UN negotiations to make progress. Nevertheless, and I'm making a long story short here, there was language adopted at COP28 that just occurred in the United Arab Emirates that is arguably very significant. And that's language agreeing to transition away from fossil fuels. Now, there's no timeline on it. And the term transition away is not as concrete as we might like. but the movement organizations that met at the end of the COP and decided how to frame this outcome, by and large, agreed that the win was to agree that it was a step forward rather than denouncing it. Because as Bill McKibben put it very well, it gives us a new tool to use against the fossil fuel cartel. It doesn't in itself guarantee anything. But again, how could the UNFCCC guarantee anything when it can't even make decisions by supermajority and has no enforcement powers? So that's basically what happened. There's obviously a million more things to say about it.
It seems to me that bringing 208 countries together and having consensus is quite impossible. But in fact, it may well become possible when climate warming produces its absolutely, it seems to me, scientists say, inevitable enormous storms and floods and enormous damage to infrastructure, great deaths and migrations of people who are living in places that are uninhabitable. At that point, it seems to me, it's possible to get the countries of the world to agree. And we're not talking about getting all 208 to agree. All of them can be sort of pay. The smaller ones, it's a very large, powerful states that wield a hammer over the others now to just extract profits from them. In a crisis, it seems to me, it's possible that you could get a consensus. Sometimes there'd be a lot of arm twisting and threats by one country against a possible country that would not agree. But it seems to me, in the crisis, with vast numbers of people dying and everybody affected, we could be lucky if that happens and it's not too late. So it seems to me the UNFCCC is important in fact, sifting out the possible solutions. So, Tom, you introduced the most noteworthy and possibly fruitful provision in this year's COP 20. There were 28 of them in this year's COP, this conference 28. You introduced the transitioning out as a tool for us to hammer and persuade the powers that be that it had to be done and quickly. And we'll be, I think, supported by what's happening on the ground, namely that something has to be done and more people will agree. I'm dubious about whether that transition language resembles a whole lot of stuff that the corporations have been saying. I mean, every company, even the fossil fuel industry itself, on their websites and in their propaganda and their advertising, they all, even the Aramco, the third largest oil industry, Shell, Chevron, all of them on their website promise that they're, in fact, doing research in alternative fuels and carbon sequestration, carbon capture and sequestration, anything but, in fact, not using a lot of oil. They want to keep doing oil, and they are now promoting all of these technological systems like carbon capture and safe nukes. Allegedly safe nukes. They're promoting all of that stuff so that they can just keep selling oil, and the companies too, they want to just keep selling goods. And the auto companies will electrify, but they want to sell a lot of SUVs, which they're doing now, the worst kind of personal transportation system. I mean, technology, the SUV. And I think that this seems to me could be just another one of their greenwashing. They've been doing greenwashing for a long time. Every company has supposedly green products and recognizes the need for dealing with climate change and that they're the good guys. Buy our goods. It's an advertising slogan without really any real effort to change things.
The corporates are so powerful, and they're always going to pretend that they're part of the solution. They're greenwashing, and the false solutions and the dangerous distractions, they're part of the political landscape. There's no question about that. And if we're taken in by them, we're in trouble. But that doesn't necessarily give us a rubric by which we can make strategic decisions. I mean, we have to, there has to be a way forward. We're not doomed. The outcome of strategic and tactical decisions that we make, you know, will make a huge difference. And the question is, you know, what we need to do. And we obviously need to regulate capital at a global level. And that involves the regulation of the corporations, but it also involves the regulation of state-based activities. You know, I mean, some of the largest oil companies in the world are not private corporations. They're actually state-owned companies, as in the Gulf region and as in China with oil companies. Capital needs to be brought under control, and it has to, that has to be done even though there's going to be greenwashing going on. The question is, how do you do it? And there's no question that the situation is desperate. But that certainly opens some doors as well as closing other doors, right? I mean, the very desperation of the situation and the need to act at a global scale and on an accelerated timeline, which is widely understood around the world, certainly opens some doors. It makes things possible that would not otherwise have been possible. So yeah, the greenwashing is real. It's a real problem, but the left contribution to the debate can't simply be to point to the greenwashing. The left also needs to make a contribution in the form of, this is what we need to do. This is our vision of transformation. And this is a strategy that we think should be pursued.
Yeah, I agree with you entirely on fighting back and having a possibility of even being heard, particularly as the climate catastrophes keep multiplying and more damaging. People will wake up and they want to be, and they demand action. There's going to be, it seems to me, World War II kind of awakening when isolationist U.S. realized that the Japanese and the fascists really was threatening ultimately the United States if they were able to conquer the rest of the world, which was an open question at that time. And I agree we have to have our own plan. I believe that energy democracy is going to emerge as the left competitor to the corporate plan. What's your sense?
And what does energy democracy mean?
Well, I have the sense that it's using currently available technologies, solar and wind, that are getting more efficient and cheaper every day, using those technologies as they develop and siting them locally where they can be locally controlled and where the public electricity provider can build a culture of energy conservation and use reduction. And it seems to me we're never going to catch up to the growing, quote, needs of the American people if, in fact, they retain if they're part of a culture of conspicuous consumption and consumption and consumption. But the possibility of local energy without having the expense of building new grids across the United States.
Totally, mostly agree with you. This is absolutely a build out that we want to do. We want to build out renewables on a massive scale and not just in the United States. I mean,
no.
The decision that was made at the COP was to triple the rate of global renewables deployment. And in order to do that, it's necessary to make significant changes in the international financial system. But yeah, absolutely. This is one of the key things we have to do to pave a path forward. I would disagree with you about the need for a new grid build out. I absolutely believe that we need a new grid. And I don't think that we can build a renewable economy for a civilization of the scale of the current civilization without massively re-architecting the grid. Because of cities, we need cities, and cities have demands. They make demands. The one of the problems with the climate debate on the left is that people tend to rat hole into these small technical questions. The questions that we should be focusing on are political economic questions, and in particular, global political economic questions. Even the renewables build out, the question of how it could happen in a very wealthy country like the United States is very different from what it will take to build out renewables, say, in Africa, which is a place that was a tremendous need for a concentrated, visionary strategy to leapfrog the entire continent to renewable systems rather than building out fossil energy systems. I mean, these are the kind of questions that are at the center of the international debate. You know, it goes without saying that the rich countries of the world, the former imperial centers, have the technological and industrial capacity and financial capacity to rework domestic infrastructure. The question is, how are we going to redo this reworking at the international level? And in particular, how are we going to do it during a time of tremendous crisis? And I mean, those are the kinds of questions that take center stage at the COP, you know. And to close the discussion, I would just make a plea to your listeners to think globally. The climate crisis is a planetary crisis. It really is. And it's coming to us at a time when the international political situation is extremely unstable and extremely dangerous. And the question is whether or not the climate mobilization can become an occasion for large-scale international cooperation rather than degenerating into another occasion for conflict and vituperation. And I do think it's possible. I do think that we can cooperate, and we need to think about that. We need to think about what it would mean to face up to the global crisis and what it means in particular for the rich parts of the world where most of the rich people live, and how the wealth of the rich is going to be redirected towards climate mobilization. I really think we need to think about those kinds of big questions.
Yeah, I think we obviously have to act internationally. There's nuclear powers all over the world that could blackmail us or set one off, which would end everything. I mean, there's so many reasons that there's ethical reasons, there's practical reasons that we have to be internationalists. But we also have to, in the United States, we have to build out models of successful model cities that, in fact, are zero carbon and real zero carbon, not the accountants zero carbon. And if we do that, and when the crunch comes, when people wake up to the huge threat, I think that we have a chance of, in fact, building that energy democracy system and defeating the corporate plan of fancy technology, doing everything the same way except having technology. Anyway.
Bill, I completely agree. Absolutely agree.
Yeah. Tom Athanasio, thanks for talking to us today.
Zap by the Avalanches here on KBOO Radio. That followed Bill Resnick talking with Tom Athanasio for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Up next, Jen Hawkins speaking with Prerna Gupta about the guiding aims of the book, Making the Unseen Visible, Science and the Contested Histories of Radiation Exposure, and about her own chapter in that book based on her research on public attitudes about the risks posed by uranium mining and nuclear technologies. Here's Jan Hocken for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Welcome to KABU, Prerna Gupta.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, congratulations on the release of the new book, Making the Unseen Visible, Science and the Contested Histories of Radiation Exposure, a collection of essays in which you are a contributing author. Your chapter looks at uranium mining in India and public attitudes about the risks posed by nuclear mining and technologies, and you draw on your research as a PhD student at the Institute for Resources, Environment, and Sustainability at the University of British Columbia, and data you collected in India for your thesis. Well, let's start with the overall scope of the book before turning to your own research. Can you talk about what drew this group of scholars together around the topic of contested histories of radiation?
Yeah, thank you so much. It is quite exciting to see the book come together. This project has largely been spearheaded by historian Jacob Hamlin and Linda Richards, who are both professors at the Oregon State University. They are also leading a project. This book was because of a workshop that they do every year, which is known as Ways of Knowing Radiation. And every year they bring together scholars from all around the world talking about histories of exposure to radiation from different nuclear facilities.
And ways of looking at radiation. So that's a term that often is associated with critical perspectives, bringing another vantage point or lens on a problem that's already been taken up by researchers. What did you bring as authors to this? It seems that it was both a research project, but one guided by social justice interests in marginalized communities, groups that have been affected by radiation exposure that often are in the periphery of what researchers generally take up.
So, you know, as in the very introduction of the book, the problem of talking about radiation exposure is brought forward, which is that it is an invisible thing, and the effects of radiation or effects from other kind of contamination that happens from nuclear facilities takes a long time before it becomes visible.
And that is a property of radiation.
That is a property of radiation, yeah. So that poses a big problem to do research on this topic. And many times, adequate measures are not taken by the industry that is producing this kind of pollution or this kind of radiation, and the impacts that it's having on people. So it is left up to a lot of independent researchers to try to bring together how we might think of the impacts from nuclear facilities. And one way to do that, which the OSU project also looks into, is oral history. So recording people's testimonies over time of how they have observed health impacts on their own bodies and what they have observed in the environment around them.
Everyday people are close observers of their environment and operate with some scientific principles in mind. And I'd like to ask you more about that as it relates to your research as well, but wanted to have you just say a bit about the editors of the volume. As you mentioned earlier, Jacob Darwin Hamblin and Linda Richards are faculty at Oregon State University and part of the Oregon State University Downwinders Project. Can you just describe what that project is? Because I think that will interest many people in the book as well.
So the Hanford Nuclear Reservation litigation, or the Downwinders case, is one of the most controversial legal struggles in the history of atomic energy. And the work of this group is basically, it has two distinct goals. The first focuses on developing an important research collection, which includes recently acquired Berger, Haber, Hanford Nuclear Reservation Downwinders case collection, working in collaboration with the Special Collections and Archives Research Center of the Oregon State University. So this involves digitizing a portion of this collection and supplementing it with the oral history interviews. And the second goal is to produce the first detailed historical studies of the DOES reconstruction project. So linking it to the issues in the history of science, environmental history, and the broad field of science and technology studies.
And there's a film out now called Downwinders that takes up some of that same work and bringing in oral history and everyday people as observers and as involved in documenting the effects of what often remains invisible or less perceptible to researchers. Well, can you describe your research project, which was an ambitious endeavor that took place over many years, as I understand, India, and that you begin your chapter with an area that's interested me for some time as well as a psychologist, the psychology and sociology of risk assessment. And one finding from this, the field of risk research, is that humans are not particularly good at assessing risk. And you kind of take up the gauntlet of that challenge and raise the question, it depends on how you approach the problem and the measures you bring. And so why did you begin there, and what was your orientation to risk assessment? I mean, you do take up some of the lead findings in that field.
Yeah, so a lot of my work is in the risk assessment or risk perception area. So usually what I've seen in this research is that there is a distinction made between what is termed as objective risk assessment by experts and a subjective emotion-laden risk perception by people. And I wanted to kind of question some of the assumptions that are there in this binary that has been posed in the literature. And I'm not the first person to do it. There are other researchers who have also talked about this before. Brian Wynn is one example from UK. So what I set on to do in this paper, I had basically two aims. One aim was to question this binary by kind of extending some arguments related to the case study of uranium mining in India and the health impacts that have been observed. And second was to show that even the actor in this case, which is the Uranium Corporation of India Limited, owned by the government, that poses itself to be objective, to be saying objective truths, is influenced by politics.
And often they are very reassuring in these objective measures, right? And they tend to downplay or gather data in a way that often leads to the findings that are meant to be very reassuring to communities. There's a long history of that with nuclear and other technologies, but the nuclear power industry is famous for its reassuring pronouncements.
Yes, and it's the same in India. There is a section on UCL's website or Nuclear Corporation India's website which says myths of radiation or myths of Jadugoda. Jadugoda is the uranium mine that I explore in the study.
What do they claim to be some examples of myths?
Well, they talk about how the radiation levels, they don't cross permissible limits. They're well within the permissible limits. The fear of people is kind of, you know, not valid. And this is where the politicization happens. They say two things. One is that the most of the diseases that are being observed near these uranium mines in Jadugoda is because of malnutrition, poor health, and unhygienic practices of the people there. And these are indigenous people. So this is a kind of stereotype that exists in the Indian society, and it is used by UCIL to shift the blame back on the people themselves. And the second is that many times they would say that all these stories that are being said about the health impacts are the work of anti-nationals or are the work of people who do not want the development of India's nuclear.
Well, there's probably something to be said for that, that you dig a little deeper when you're critical of an industry, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You don't accept the memo at face value.
Yeah, definitely.
So I found part of your chapter that was interesting in how you approach the subjective and the dismissal of everyday concerns about uranium mining is how you approach what's called spiritist explanations or spiritual explanations that are often dismissed by researchers as forms of superstition. Can you give some examples? Because you do describe ideas about evil spirits inhabiting the area.
Well, in my opinion, I wasn't trying to come from a spiritist perspective or anything like that. I was merely reporting what people have said what people have observed over a period of time. And yes, in their explanation, so the example I think you might be referring to is there was a tree under which when people would pass, they would say that you'll have a miscarriage. And they thought that this was because there were evil spirits living on that tree. Later, they found out that it was because of some contamination from the uranium mines. So that explanation changed when they understood that uranium mining in the area is causing some pollution, which is leading to some health impacts. But the first way of understanding it was from their own kind of way of knowing, to think about it as some kind of evil spirits. And this is not the only kind of example. You know, like workers observed that, you know, if they were cut by mine rock, wounds will not heal very quickly. It would take a long time for them to heal. Women were having a lot of miscarriages living around the area. So there is a local midwife that says that the number of miscarriages has increased. They were observing kids being born with abnormalities. And farmers were observing that some of the fruits would have deformed seeds, which was increasing over time as well.
So you're saying that there's an initial perception or apperception of disturbing influences on the environment where people draw on kind of ready-made language or meaning system for expressing their disturbance, but then over time can incorporate their knowledge of the material sources of some of these bad effects. That it's, I think you're saying it's not that people who adopt a mystical explanation are somehow unable to also incorporate scientific explanations.
Exactly. That's what I'm trying to say. And also, you know, risk perception is always kind of put into this kind of cognitive model where it is focused on an individual and how an individual has biases or heuristics that lead them to form certain risk perceptions. But as many scholars of risks have argued, so Mary Douglas is one, Brian Wynne is another, that it is not just about your cognitive biases. Risks are made in our social and cultural context, and people make sense of them in those contexts as well. So in this example, after UCL has operated for decades, you know, people start understanding what kind of institution this is. And as Brian Wynne talks about people's social experience of risk, of institutions that make risks. And this is even found in psychometric studies, you know, that trust is a big factor in understanding people's risk perception. If you do not trust the institution, you will perceive a higher risk from whatever risk that institution is creating.
And of course, the industry, certainly in the US, has manipulated that finding in various ways to instill trust, to have promotional materials and spokespeople of a status that is believed to cultivate trust. How have, moving to the activist side of your project, I know we met last fall at the University of British Columbia around both our interest in nuclear power, the industry and its propaganda, but also our interest in activism and social change and civic dialogue. How has that part of your research proceeded in India? What kinds of conversations do you hope to have in anti-nuclear activism there?
Wow, that's a big question. So
the big question here too, doesn't have a happy answer, but we still have to
tackle it. Yeah. So I've been involved with activism around nuclear issues for a while now, both with respect to nuclear weapons, nuclear energy, uranium mining. And my research is motivated by my experience with social movements in India. As a researcher, I believe that I want to position myself in a space that can support social movements or can create a rigorous scholarship that can bring forth the opinions or the ideologies being put forth by social movements. So that's how I see myself as a researcher doing scholarly work. And I feel like, you know, when you're studying medicine or any kind of exact sciences, it is very much accepted that if you study something, you will apply it. But as social scientists, this kind of, if you're studying about society, I don't see why it's a problem that you want to apply it to the society as well, to make it better. And I think that should be one of the goals of any social scientist, to apply what they've learned to make society better.
Yeah, and of course, there are different visions of that, from radical transformative visions that aim to transform capitalism and the patriarchal, heterosexist, racist institutions that it's been built on. And then there are more liberal projects that are more incremental, fighting for reforms here and there when you can. And of course, these go hand in hand. But do you see your work and the civic aspects of it as part of a broader climate justice movement, or where would you place it in that framework in India? It's a hard country, as I understand it, particularly now, to be fighting for social justice and equity as it is here.
Yeah, I think the BJP-led, the kind of Hindu right-wing government that is in power right now has been curbing any kind of dissent in India. The media, for example, has basically become a propaganda machine for the government. So it is a difficult time, definitely. And sorry, I forgot the second part of the question.
Are there spaces in India area? I mean, it's a very big country and a very complex country in terms of the regions and the political makeup and demographics. Are there places in India where you see more potential for climate justice work that includes this focus on nuclear, but a broader vision of going beyond both carbon and nuclear energy and the militaries that are driving them, but looking for something beyond this ruinous terrain we now inhabit?
Yeah, I think that is my next big question, kind of how to think about environmental issues in India and how to incorporate that into larger, you know, mainstream politics as well. And that is very challenging at the moment. I do have a lot of hope from, when it comes to climate change, from the young generation. I think they're very vocal about that in India. And India has a rich history of environmental movements as well. The difference that it has from Western countries, the environmental movements in Western countries, is that in India, all environmental movements are also social movements. It is always connected to the questions of land and livelihood as well. So if you take, for example, the anti-dam movement in central part of India, known as the Narmada Bachao movement, the biggest questions, yes, ecology was important, but also for people, displacement that was going to happen because of the dams, how it was going to impact their traditional livelihoods. And because how dependent people, a lot of people are still on nature, on forests, on kind of the richness of the land, these questions become both environmental and social at the same time. And so I think if we have to talk about environmental issues in India, we have to see it from that lens.
Well, I look forward to hearing more as you take your findings out on the road and continue to work both as a researcher and an activist scholar. And congratulations on completing this research and participating in the book. And in closing, Prerna Gupta, tell us where we can find this wonderful, illuminating book. It speaks to so many important issues of our time, bringing a lens on radiation exposure and the industry's impacts, and how everyday people carry not only impacts, but histories and insights on the problem. It's called Making the Unseen Visible: Science and the Contested Histories of Radiation Exposure. Where can people find the book?
So this book is published by the Oregon State University Press, and you can find it on their website and purchase it there. It can be internationally shipped.
Good. Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining me on the Old Mole Variety Hour here in KBOO today. Prerna Gupta, keep up the good work.
Thank you so much for having me.
Anna by the Pixies here on KBOO Radio. That followed Jan Hocken, with Prerna Gupta for the Old Mall Variety Hour. Finally, this episode, here's Laurie Mercier for the Old Mall speaking with Julia Ford of Jewish Voice for Peace Portland about the group's efforts to compel the U.S. government to stop Israel's war on Gaza and to insist on freedom, justice, and equality for Palestinians. Here's Laurie Mercier for the Old Mall Variety Hour.
This is Laurie Mercier for the Old Mall Variety Hour. I'm speaking today with Julia Ford with Jewish Voice for Peace Portland about the group's activism in support of the Palestinian struggle. Julia Ford is an American Jew who grew up here in Portland, though her parents and their parents before are very firmly East Coast. She's a member of Jewish Voice for Peace, and elsewhere in her life works at the intersection of technology, nonprofits, and melding the two towards systems change. Welcome to KBOO, Julia.
Thanks, Lori. Really happy to be here.
Well, Jewish Voice for Peace has been around since the 1990s, but since October 7th, it has grown enormously, both nationally and locally in Portland. Tell us about JVP goals and why it's important to have Jewish voices in the forefront of criticisms of U.S.-Israel policies towards Palestine.
Yeah, it's a good and broad question. So JVP's goals in this existing moment are first and foremost to call for a permanent ceasefire and an end to the continued military aid to Israel from the U.S. government. Broadly, and as you mentioned, JVP's been around for 3 decades at this point, but there is a collective movement of Jews across the country, across the world, who are all working additionally to say ceasefires first and foremost, it's absolutely necessary. We need to end the occupation of Gaza, of the West Bank. We need to change the apartheid system of government that exists in the region, and we need to fight for liberation for Palestinians on the whole. And I think the sort of like how, why, and the wave of people that we're seeing right now activate is very much in response to the current like downright assault on Gaza. But I do want to say that there's been hundreds of thousands of Jews for decades who have been fighting even prior to October 7th, recognizing that what is happening in Gaza, in the West Bank, in Palestine, Israel as a whole, is just very, very counter to a core tenet of Judaism, which is that it's kind of imperative for us as Jews to speak up when others are oppressed. And it is wild in this moment, or in the last 75 years, 100 years, depending on how far back you want to go, that we've sort of conflated a religion and ethnicity with a nation state.
Well, Jewish Voice for Peace Portland recently participated in a powerful demonstration on December 14th, the last night of Hanukkah, on the Burnside Bridge. Tell us about that action.
It was incredibly powerful, I think. So there were 8 major cities across the U.S., thousands of Jews and allies who mobilized to acknowledge the fact that Hanukkah is a time for commemoration. It's a time for pause. It's actually a time in celebration of resilience, of revolution, and that in this moment where we come together as Jews to think through and acknowledge what is ostensibly a story, right? But this idea of the Maccabees reclaiming a temple from the Greeks and having this like miracle of light, that the light is really hard to find right now, and that we need to look within each other and stand up together to say that liberation of one people cannot and will not occur at the oppression and subjugation of others, and that the fight for freedom for everybody is the fight for freedom for Jews. And so there was a lot of singing and storytelling. There were a number of Palestinians and Jews and allies who spoke. And again, just this idea of how could we possibly have any type of business as usual in Portland, across the U.S., when there is just this all-out massacre of Palestinians happening. And unfortunately, it's happening in the name of Jews, you know, however that is being propagandized in this moment.
And this was a powerful action because there were 7 other cities that also had demonstrations on bridges or shut down bridges in major cities across the country. So this was coordinated nationally, right?
It was. It was coordinated nationally. And more broadly, there's been over 90 protests nationally in less than 2 months. And I can say quite emphatically that those won't be stopping until there's a permanent ceasefire.
Well, I imagine they won't be stopping since just this week, despite the horrific humanitarian catastrophe and genocide facing over 2 million residents of Gaza, Israel has pledged to expand its war, claiming in the last few days that it's going to continue its bombing and military operations for months until supposedly all Hamas leaders are killed. And the Biden administration continues to do nothing to stop Israel's campaign besides tepid pleas to avoid targeting civilians. I mean, what does this mean for the anti-war, pro-Palestine, and Jewish Voice for Peace movements in the coming days?
I think it's really important to acknowledge, because everything that you said is true and it can feel incredibly bleak and demotivating. However, we know that 70% of people in the United States support a ceasefire. And if anything, what is happening right now and sort of just this blatant disregard for what voters want, what humans are asking for, it's a call to action for all of us. We've got to continue to show up. We've got to continue to be loud. We've got to continue to call and write and email. I think we need to continue to elevate and tell the stories of people who are on the ground in Gaza, of the Israelis who are fighting for a ceasefire as well, whose voices are being oppressed and subjugated in this moment. And in terms of like, what does this mean more broadly? I think Netanyahu and the Israeli government, you know, for years and years, they've had become progressively more right wing. And what we're seeing is not something that just came to be after the horrific events on October 7th. This is a sort of lifelong mandate of Netanyahu's government to annihilate Palestine. And they feel like they have carte blanche right now. And therefore, it is all the more of a moral imperative for those of us in the US to stand up and say, hey, listen, this is not going to happen in our name if you're Jewish. It's not going to happen with my tax dollars or our tax dollars if you're not Jewish, if you are Jewish, if you're anything. And yeah, we have a continued onus and obligation to stand up and use our voices in kind of like whatever we can to at least make it very clear that genocide and apartheid and the forced displacement of people are doing absolutely nothing to make anybody safer, and that war is not the answer.
And despite this kind of massive mobilization that's occurred just in the last few months, and just the unmovable Biden administration, what about Congress? The fact that despite Oregon's progressive reputation, its entire congressional delegation, aside from Jeff Merkley, have not called for a ceasefire. So what can be done to push Wyden, especially in Bonamici, Hoyle, Blumenauer, Salinas, the whole crew, to demand a ceasefire?
Yeah, I think as of right now, there's like very, very powerful narrative at play, and it is deep. This idea that anti-Zionism, which is saying Zionism, just to be very clear, it's a political and national ideology. It's this idea that Jews and a Jewish nation state are somehow necessary in order to ensure Jewish safety. So when we talk about Zionism, when we talk about anti-Zionism, we're talking about a political and national ideology. So not a religion, not an ethnicity, not a race. And the existence and sort of promotion of Zionism, it's settler colonialism. It's the positioning of a group of people over another. And it's a very intentional diversion from the reality of what Zionism, again, as a political and national ideology, has enabled, which is a continued expulsion of Palestinians from their land, their homes. That notion that if you speak up against Israel, if you are calling for a ceasefire, which I would say, especially here in Portland, historically, we have no problem flooding the streets when there is a war that is being enacted and spearheaded by the US. We are out. For some reason in this moment, not this moment, but the last 90 days, we've seen a hesitation and we've seen people shy away from what is very simple, saying, no, we don't support mass war and mass murder of civilians. And instead, we're hearing people say, I don't get involved in international politics, or I'm just, you know, a local representative, or Israel has the right to defend itself. And to me, the reason that there's this hesitation, this stutter step, this inability for our elected officials to be representing the will of the people. Again, 70% of people in the US support a ceasefire. So to your point about like, why are they not stepping up and in? It's because there's this very powerful narrative that to be an anti-Zionist means that you're anti-Semitic, which is absolutely ludicrous. But that is powerful. And Jews for decades have been told, Israel is your homeland. You have a right. You could get on a plane, never having been there, having no family there, and get citizenship. Your Palestinian friends, though, whose grandparents were expelled in the Nakba, like, they can never go. They could never return there. But you have a birthright. And there's this weird tie that is being exploited to perpetuate this war, this genocide of Palestinian that's happening, where you've got folks saying, you cannot speak out against Israel because then you're anti-Semitic. And so I think that is why we're not seeing more of our elected representatives call for a ceasefire. I think that is why the representatives who have used their voice, some of them incredibly bravely, who came out right away to say, hey, a violent escalation is not what we need. We need to have peace. We need to have international intervention. We need to figure out a solution that allows for everybody, Jews, Palestinians, to live with safety. Those folks have been targeted. They've been targeted by the media, again, for something that is, if you take a step back, mind-boggling, which is we're calling for peace. We are calling to say everybody deserves equal rights, and we're being told that that is controversial. And so we are not seeing our representatives uphold the will of the people right now, and I think they are scared, and I also think that they're operating with, quite frankly, misinformation and propaganda that has perpetuated the entire American political system. And we've got to do a really good job coming together to combat that narrative. That was a very long answer to your question.
Well, that was great, Julia. And I think also we have to consider just the financial implications, since Congress runs on money, unfortunately, and AIPAC, the PAC that supports Israel, is very powerful in this country and has threatened those who have called for a ceasefire. I think it's also interesting to note that most of the congressional representatives who have supported Cori Bush's resolution to demand a ceasefire have mostly been people of color. And, you know, that's something that should be pointed out to Oregon's congressional delegation, I think, that they should stand with people of color who also, you know, recognize this apartheid state that the United States is supporting.
It's such an important point. And I think that the very unfortunate fact is that in our continued quest to sort of maintain the narrative that Jewish safety is tied to Israel, and that fighting for equal rights and self-determination and freedom for Palestinians, and saying that that is anti-Semitic, that actually many, many true anti-Semites are being platformed, like the Mike Johnsons, the John Hagees of the world. And they're being given that platform by AIPAC, by the pro-Israel lobby. And so we need to interrogate why, especially as Portlanders. If we were in the streets for Black Lives Matter, if we believe that liberation is shared and we all need to work together, why there is a hesitation to show up for Palestinians? And to your point, why is it that most of the people who are calling for a ceasefire are women and people of color? You know, I have a cousin who I love, who is a religious Jew. She's a member of Chabad, and she was very active during Black Lives Matter. And it's been incredibly painful to be in conversation with her, but really important over the last few months. And she said to me, she said, you know, I don't want Marjorie Taylor Greene speaking for me. Like, I don't understand why AOC and Cori Bush, like, why they're not speaking out for Jews. And that opened this incredible and painful door of conversation around, again, this idea of conflating a nation state with an ethnicity or a religion, and really like the white supremacist ideology that goes into creating a nation state and something like Israel. So yes, it's a broader conversation, and it's really important, and it's really important in this moment. And I want to invite all listeners to find the representatives in Oregon who have called for a ceasefire, and show them some love. It really is, a ceasefire is the bare minimum, but those who have called for it are getting a lot of backlash, and we want to motivate them to continue. Because again, a ceasefire is just step one. We need to be fighting, fighting, fighting to get there, and then we cannot stop fighting. We have to fight for an end to the occupation, an end to the siege. So yeah, find the ones who have signed on. I can give you a URL if that's appropriate, and flood their inboxes and just ask them to keep showing up to represent the will of the people.
Thank you so much, Julia Ford, for joining us today on the Old Mole Variety Hour. We will link to the JVP website, and I should point out that Portland Jewish Voice for Peace is also on Instagram and Facebook. And on the Instagram and website, there is some great footage from the Hanukkah Bridge shutdown that people should check out. So thanks again, Julia.
Thanks for having me, Lori.
This has been the Old Mole Variety Hour for the 1st of January, 2024. I'm John Nelson. Thanks to Lori Mercier, Jan Hocken, and Bill Resnick, and their guests Julia Ford, Prerna Gupta, and Tom Athanasio. You can find this episode alongside other archived episodes of The Old Mole in Time at kboo.fm. Just search for The Old Mole Variety Hour. Suggestions, comments, or questions can be sent from the webpage there or to oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com.